Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 1st, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Vitakkasiddhanta Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches that the refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path brings a relaxed and peaceful quality of mind. This is a remarkable sutta that I refer to often, as it really speaks to the essential foundation and the overall context of the Buddha's Dhamma, and that's the Four Noble Truths and gaining insight into the three marks of existence. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Those online, there's a chat window to the right. If you want to ask a question or make a comment or just say hello, that'd be nice. You could do that there. This morning's talk is on the Vitakkasiddhanta Sutta. As in all the Buddhist teachings, this is taught in the context of what he awakened to, dependent origination, which simply states from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences arise. And so then he taught the Four Noble Truths to bring an understanding to that. And when seen in the proper context, the Four Noble Truths describe the three marks of existence, which is what the entire Buddhist teachings is presented to gain insight into: the impermanent nature of all things, the not-self characteristic, the word that's used is anatta, which simply means that the views that we're holding to constitute a self are rooted in that initial ignorance and do not accurately describe a self in its environment. They're wrong views. Why are you laughing? They're wrong views, let go of those views because they're not a self. And because of a misunderstanding of who we are and the environment, the impermanent environment that we live in, unsatisfactory experiences arise. In a word, dukkha. Lorna, I want to know what you're laughing at.
The simplicity.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
And the difficulty. And sometimes it just catches you funny, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because, and you might agree with this, because of its utter simplicity that we have difficulty grasping it. Why? Because our minds are distracted. They're confused. That's the reason why the Buddha taught meditation. The only reason was to deepen concentration so we can take an honest look at our minds, a realistic look at our minds. That's called refined mindfulness. And when I get to the sutta, you'll see that. This sutta, the reason why I'm giving this background and this introduction, is this sutta is a good example of many suttas that if you simply look at this sutta and don't understand the context, you won't understand how to apply it, and you'll likely misapply it and create doctrines that you might even call Buddhist teachings because you got it from a sutta, but it's lacking the proper application because it's lacking the proper framework of Four Noble Truths and dependent origination. So the Four Noble Truths begin, the first statement that the Buddha made is that dukkha occurs, suffering occurs, disappointment occurs. He described that suffering as birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering, receiving what is undesired is suffering. Those are two aspects of craving or desire, aren't they? And then he would always conclude that statement on dukkha saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. And the five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. But this is consciousness not with a big C, a grand cosmic consciousness that unites us all in some amorphous soup of ignorance, but a consciousness with a small C, which simply describes ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Again, everything is in that context. And there's a lot of information, and I get plenty of talks on the five clinging aggregates. But the best description is to understand them as just the personal ongoing experience of suffering rooted in ignorance. So the first noble truth is dukkha occurs. The second noble truth is that craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha, suffering. And so it's craving rooted in ignorance of who we truly are that initiates that. We want something, anything we find that gives us pleasure or as a distraction from an unsatisfactory experience, we crave for it and we cling to it once we've had the experience of it, whether it's an object, event, a view, or an idea. And ultimately, this all comes down to views and ideas, what we're thinking about. Something occurs to us that is unsatisfactory. Because we're taking life personally, because of wrong view, we create a clinging to not wanting to have that experience. And that is a misunderstanding of impermanence. If we simply take a breath, most of us that have been developing the Dhamma even a short while see the great benefit, and when we find ourselves agitated in some way, to simply take a breath, and whatever that feeling that is agitating or distracting usually vanishes pretty quickly by simply coming back to the breath and the body. The radical teaching that is often overlooked because of the misapplications of what the Buddha is teaching is ultimately it's about uniting the mind in the body. Now think about that. If we really want to live our life as our life occurs, we have to be where life is occurring for us, isn't it? And that's experienced in the body at the sixth sense base. We went through a series of talks on restraint at the sixth sense base. That's why. And there's a new category on the website, Wisdom of Restraint, that covers those talks. It is at that point of contact with the outer world that we mold our inner world and our view of ourselves in relation to the world. And if that inner world that we're describing to ourselves is rooted in the ignorance of the way things truly are, the three marks of existence, then we're going to be describing ourselves to the world and back to ourselves in a way that's rooted in ignorance. Last Tuesday, I gave a talk on the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes the process of his awakening and recognizing that feedback loop that he's caught up in between views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths and a consciousness that is interpreting what's occurring from that ignorance, and how we just get stuck in it. And it becomes what I call, and what refers to anatta, the not-self characteristic, as self-referential views, which simply means we take everything personally. Everything that occurs to us, we apply to ourselves as whether I like it or I dislike it, or what mostly occurs is that we are ambiguous to what's occurring. But that's another form of distraction that I won't get into. So let me get into the sutta, and then we'll see how this relates directly to Four Noble Truths and Dependent Origination. The Buddha was at Savatthi in Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. He addressed those assembled. When one is intent on developing heightened, I like to use the word refined mindfulness, there are five qualities of mind they should attend to. Now the Buddha's teaching a very specific application of mindfulness. It's good to be mindful of what's occurring, but often modern mindfulness is simply applied in a very random and generalized way to be mindful of what you're doing. That's great, but most of us can't do that because we haven't developed the refined mindfulness that is developed through the Eightfold Path. In other words, the Eightfold Path brings that refined mindfulness that we are mindfully aware of what's occurring in life as life occurs without fractionating, if that's a word, I'll use it anyway, without fractionating life, without taking a specific thing, such as, well, I'm washing the dishes, so I'll be mindful of washing the dishes, and that's often a substitute for a complete Buddhist practice. Or I'll be mindful of walking. A very famous teacher teaches mindfulness mostly in applying it to while we're walking and moving, which is fine, but that's the result of a well-developed Eightfold Path practice rather than an individual practice. You'll see what I'm talking about when I get to this. Number one, when one's thoughts are unskillful and arising from craving and delusion, they should be mindful of their unskillful thoughts. Why? In my word, why? In order to abandon unskillful thoughts. That's the point of concentration and the framework of the Eightfold Path, to recognize what is unskillful and do what with it, not analyze it, not pick it apart, not spend 10 days focused on it and calling that an insight practice. They recognize it and abandon it. That's all. Because it's getting caught up in the analysis or the overemphasis of giving power to these impermanent thoughts that simply reinforces them in our mind.
But my thoughts are so remarkable.
Yes. And thank you, Jen. And because And you are, and if I can take what you brought up just a step further, because you are unique and remarkable in your thoughts, you should hold on to your thoughts and let them contribute to further dukkha for you. Jen, if everybody didn't pick it, Jen just described modern mindfulness.
Yes.
Because they're my thoughts, then that's really the essence of it. I'm different than everyone else, and I can wallow around and pick apart my thoughts because they're my thoughts. That's called being entangled in our thoughts. That's an act of mindless mindfulness. We're applying mindfulness in an unskillful way. And why didn't the Buddha just awaken and say, listen, you guys are going to be good if you just go meditate a little bit and be mindful. And he could have spent the next 45 years of his life doing something else other than teaching the Dhamma moment to moment. But he knew that wasn't enough to just say be mindful, because he knew that's the problem. We are mindful. But we're mindful, the mindfulness we're applying as a common human condition is rooted in ignorance of the way things are. So the mindfulness the Buddha taught is to develop a very heightened or refined mindfulness framed by the Eightfold Path. Simply so we can see our ignorance and do what, as he teaches here, simply abandon it. Don't analyze it. There's no value in it. That's just a further distraction. And you get caught up, as Jen pointed out, becoming so enamored with your own thoughts. And that really is the problem. Ultimately, the problem is recognizing how in love we are with our thoughts. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we thought them. That great saying by, I can't remember his name now.
Descartes?
Yeah, I think, therefore I am, which is taken as a defining mantra of humanity, is one of the most misleading and probably hurtful quotes ever, because we become so enamored with our thoughts, and because I'm thinking it, it must be true. That's the only qualification we give our thoughts, when we're lacking the framework of how to judge reality, the not self characteristic. And so because of that, the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path to recognize and abandon the thoughts that we are clinging to, the second aspect of the second noble truth. Craving for and clinging to ultimately resolve in our thoughts. Thanks, Jen, that was great.
Yes, it was.
Let me go back one sentence to keep it in. Be mindful of their unskillful thoughts in order to abandon unskillful thoughts. Once unskillful thoughts have been abandoned, they can now cultivate skillful thoughts guided by the Eightfold Path. The entire Dhamma is in that one paragraph. Once we have recognized unskillful thoughts, the Eightfold Path begins and ends with wrong view, which implies that the beginning of the Eightfold Path is simply accepting that the views I'm holding of myself in relation to the world, a simpler way of saying it is my views are wrong views. How do we know that? How can we begin to accept that? Because we've been drawn to, I'll call it a spiritual practice in general for a reason, and the Buddha's teachings very specifically, because we find that there's something missing in our lives, whether it's manifesting as a recognizable disappointment or agitation, or we find that we're not living in the world with the way we think we could be. There's something that draws us to look at life in a different way. That's the initial recognition that my views are wrong views. We might not be able to recognize that we're applying that to everything that's occurring in our life, but that's the initial beginning. That opens the door, that initial acceptance that my views are not always correct. Let me find a way to develop right view. That's what the Buddha set out for when he was 29 and realized when he was 35, that he was living from a point of view of wrong view, and he had now developed right view. Meaning he had awakened. He became, in his words, a rightly self-awakened one. And the Buddha consistently described awakening in completely unambiguous and completely, non-mystical or non-magical terms, simply as saying that right view is a view that has a profound understanding of dukkha, of the nature of suffering. And he described the quality of mind, again, in completely unambiguous, non-mystical, non-magical terms as calm. That's it. And of course, these are human qualities that we can develop. It's not, the reason why I'm saying that is this is not something that is beyond us as human beings. The Buddha taught a Dhamma for each and every human being who is interested to awaken in this lifetime, and literally to awaken in this moment or the next moment. Not in, the reason I'm saying that is not in future lifetimes. It doesn't take eons and eons to develop awakening. It simply takes wholehearted engagement with the Eightfold Path and a little bit of brevity and lightness. They can now cultivate thoughts guided by the Eightfold Path. With unskillful thoughts abandoned, one's mind calms and concentration increases. Again, describing the results of a well-informed, well-developed, well-integrated Eightfold Path Dhamma practice. Number two, if unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion arise again, Buddha's teaching impermanence here also, isn't he? Within the Dhamma practice, we may find, just about everyone here, in fact, I would say everyone here, has been able to recognize and abandon unskillful thoughts and developed a measure of calm, even if it's just for a brief moment, and then number two occurs. It happens again, doesn't it? The Buddha, think about the brilliance of this man, but it's brilliance rooted in his own understanding. He knows this is what's going to be going on with the rest of us, and he's teaching us to be gentle with ourselves and simply continue. If unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion arise again, one should be mindful of the suffering brought by these thoughts, recognizing, and this is in quotes again, these thoughts are unskillful and will lead to more confusion, delusion, and stress. Remind ourselves that. Being mindful of the drawbacks of unskillful thoughts, these thoughts can now be abandoned. Again, pointing, don't analyze it, don't pick apart it. Don't try to blame, if I'm sitting in meditation, I remember that person got me upset because of what they said or they looked at me sideways. And normally my mind would go to this scenario of how they're wrong and what's wrong with them and how awful they are and how awful the world is. And blah, blah. Simply recognize that you're caught in an unskillful thought and abandon it. Because if you continue the distraction that is rooted in ignorance, what are you doing? You're simply continuing ignorance. And our minds often go to placing blame outside of ourselves for justification for how we feel, don't we? I mean, that is and look at the world, today, and specifically look at the politics in our country today. That's exactly what they're doing. Extreme views are blaming each other for how they feel and what's wrong in the world. And I'm not going to make a political statement rather than what we used to do, which is try to find the middle ground and see, but we don't do that anymore. The Buddha taught an Eightfold Path as the middle way between, and now I'm not making a political statement, between the extreme views arising in our own mind. And it is an extreme view to not take responsibility for what we're thinking in this moment. Why is it an extreme view? Because it's rooted in the not-self characteristic, which is seeing life from only one point of view, a view of self-preservation, but self-preservation rooted in wrong views. And I really should qualify that as saying self-referential preservation rather than freedom. Number three, if unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion continue to arise, while being mindful of the drawbacks of these thoughts, meaning having now developed a measure of integration of the Eightfold Path, but we find that our minds are still going back to unskillful thoughts, while being mindful of the drawbacks of these thoughts, one should pay no attention to these thoughts. Simply stop. Not stop what? Stop. Stop thinking that way. Now, the Buddha realizes that's not entirely possible. But as we're developing our Dhamma practice, when we find ourselves caught up in unskillful thoughts, stop it. Come back to what's occurring. Because those types of unskillful thoughts are only possible when a mind is objectified outside of its body and projected towards the future or stuck in the past and reacting from that. A mind that is truly united in the body is always calm and always at peace no matter what's occurring. And that's why I often use the phrase to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. When you recognize something that cannot be approved of, as we develop the Dhamma correctly, we recognize the significant distinction between approval and acceptance. A mind rooted in the calm and peace of the Eightfold Path recognizes that it might not necessarily approve of something, but it accepts it because it's simply what's occurring. That's the sign of maturity. That's an awakened mind. So we learn that we can approve of something. Somebody might be in our face in a mean way, and we don't approve of it, but we don't have to. That's approval is part of an ego personality. We accept it simply because what's occurring, and we don't react. And that mind leads to diffusing the conflict because we're not pushing back on something like that. But it also applies to when something that makes us feel good and we become agitated towards wanting more of it. It's the same thing. Practice restraint there. That's what the Buddha's taught. Simply stop. And it's not always possible. With unskillful thoughts abandoned, one's mind calms and concentration increases by simply doing that, by simply practicing that level of refined mindfulness. The Buddha continues, if unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion, again, referencing back to the Second Noble Truth, driven by craving and delusion, continue to arise while being mindful of the drawbacks of these thoughts, one should focus on relaxing the mental fabrications with regards to unskillful thoughts. Focus on the mental fabrications. Again, this is the Buddha's not talking about analyzing this, but recognize that we have created an objectified view, a fabrication of what's occurring. Focus on that momentarily. Recognize that it's because of a fabrication. A fabrication, I can't think of the name of the sutta right now, but we gave a series of talks on fabrications. I think it's the Upada Sutta, but maybe not. A fabrication is a perversion. This is the word that one translator, Tana Sarabhika, uses. It's a perversion of what's occurring. It means that we have used poor judgment and wrong views to interpret what's occurring, so we've created something that's rooted in ignorance. It's a fabrication. It's not really what's occurring. It's rooted in wrong view. And again, it can only lead to further confusion, delusion, and suffering. The Buddha is saying, recognize that this is occurring because of a fabrication. Dependent origination starts by saying, from ignorance as a requisite condition, a required condition, comes fabrication. And then there's 11 more chains in that chain of dependencies leading to suffering. It's fabrications, it's objectified thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all suffering. That's what the Buddha is referring to. So as we're developing our Dhamma practice, and we're using mindfulness in these other ways to recognize and abandon unskillful thoughts and resulting actions, to simply abandon that. And if we find that that's not possible, there's different ways of addressing it. We can mindfully stop. We can stop our minds. We can gain control of our thinking. This sutta and the Bhadakarata Sutta talk about thinking what we want to think when we want to think it, which means we gain complete control of our thoughts moment by moment. Most people don't even want to do that because we're so enamored with having a mind that can think anything that it wants and attach itself to those thoughts. Again, another aspect of awakening is gaining full control of our thinking. The Buddha concludes that step with saying, relaxation of mental fabrication, with the intentional relaxation of mental fabrications, one's mind calms and concentration increases. The instructions during meditation is relax our thoughts, return our mindfulness to our breathing. It relates directly to this thought, to this sutta, and the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha uses similar words. Relax your thoughts. But think about an unrelaxed, a good visual would be holding on to our thoughts with our fists clenched around our thoughts. These are my thoughts. I'm not going to let go of them because they're mine. I own them. Well, those thoughts are rooted in impermanence. Let them go. Relax your thoughts. Relax your grip on your thoughts. What happens? Your mind calms and concentration increases. That's exactly what we do in meditation, isn't it? We find that we're caught up in our thoughts. We relax the grip on our thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing. Do you see how the Buddha taught a very specific but very simple Dhamma practice that when it's adapted, accommodated, or embellished in any way, it's lost completely? Meditation is for deepening concentration, which is a direct experience during meditation of relaxing the grip on our thoughts and deepening concentration. The mind calms. The ultimate goal of the Buddha's Dhamma. Now again, just to emphasize it in here, the Buddha didn't teach just meditation. He He taught a very specific meditation practice called Shamatha Vipassana meditation as one factor of eight to develop the refined mindfulness that finally unites the mind and the body and allows one to awaken. Number five. If unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion continue to arise, while being mindful of the relaxing the mental fabrications with regard to unskillful thoughts, one should develop right intention in order to abandon unskillful thoughts with continued refined mindfulness. Excuse me. Right intention is the second factor of the Eightfold Path. The first factor is right view. Right intention is the intention, and it relates directly to the second noble truth. Right view relates directly to the first noble truth, a profound understanding of dukkha occurring. The second factor of the Eightfold Path relates to the second factor of the Four Noble Truths. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. Right intention is the intention, holding in mind, which is what that means. Holding in mind, moment by moment as best we can, the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. That's what the sutta is speaking to. Right intention, being mindful of right intention, of recognizing in the moment, which again refers to practicing restraint at the sixth sense base. When is my mind becoming agitated? And if it is, my intention is to recognize and abandon craving and clinging in this moment. Sometimes we talk about it a little bit more simplified way is when we find our mind is agitated, to just remind ourselves, take a breath, unite your mind and your body in the moment, and remind yourself, wait a minute, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. We start depersonalizing something that we take personal. And guess what? We find that there's nothing personal in life. And what does that lead to? When we stop taking everything personal, when we stop taking anything personal, we have developed an understanding of suffering and our minds are at peace. Isn't that remarkable? That's what all this points to. That one simple thought. We spend a lot of time emphasizing this on retreat. And in that 3.5-day framework, it really becomes clear. But reinforcing that thought, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And think about this is a useful exercise to take outside of meditation practice. Concentrate your mind and then think about things that have occurred recently that agitate yourself. Stop analyzing it. Stop. And just remind yourself, wait a minute. This is not me. This is not who I am. This is not what I am. And you'll quickly realize that you've personalized something that is completely impersonal. Even if it's something like somebody in your face accusing you of something or calling you something, or even if it's an outwardly event that you're overemphasizing and taking way too personal. Because when you can recognize it in yourself, when you can depersonalize it within yourself, you're depersonalizing it in the other person and you're allowing them to be what they are, which may in the moment be ignorant of Four Noble Truths, which is why they might be reacting in a certain way, or the reason why ideologies are coming to the fore out in the world around us and they won't disturb us anymore. We'll be able to maintain a calm and peaceful mind. With the intentional abandonment of unskillful thoughts, one's mind calms and concentration increases. Now, when a practitioner recognizes unskillful thoughts, understands unskillful thoughts, paying no mind to unskillful thoughts, that's so important because often if we're not being gentle with ourselves and still personalizing our Dhamma practice, when an unskillful thought arises, we'll say, oh, I can't do this. There's something wrong with me. The Buddha is simply stating and understanding that that is what's going to occur. And the essence of Dhamma practice is being gentle with ourselves, knowing that that's what's going to occur in the moment, and abandon it. Because, again, judging ourselves or the Dhamma practice in any way is just an ongoing distraction. It's taking it personal. Paying no mind to unskillful thoughts, attending to the relaxation of mental fabrications with regards to those thoughts, and using right mindfulness, very specific mindfulness, using refined mindfulness and right intention to steady their mind, settle their mind, unify their mind and concentrate their mind right within, a mind united with its body. This is a person with mastery of the thought sequences, mastery of their thoughts. Isn't that wonderful? And I bet there's an underlying motivation for every one of us coming here to Dhamma practice and coming here today. We realize that we don't have mastery of our thoughts. Another way that the Buddha describes the not-self characteristic is that anything that arises that we don't have mastery over cannot be us. Think about that. That is such a profound statement that it's hard to really get our minds about that. But if we don't have mastery of it, how could it be us? How could it? Unless we're willing to give away every bit of power that we might have, and I'm not talking about an ego-driven power, the power to awaken. We give that away when we say, I don't have any mastery over my thoughts. I can't. But we've recognized, even if we're not, if the thought isn't clarified yet, that the reason why we're suffering, why we're having disappointing experiences, is because we don't have mastery over our thoughts. Another way of saying that is we've lost our minds. A slightly more gentle way, and maybe more accurate, is we've lost our mindfulness. The Buddha teaches right mindfulness. That's what he's referring to here. Lauren.
I can't understand and grasp exactly what that phrase means, to be mastery over your thoughts and how it can be. I don't...
Can you, and I think you can, because you've talked about it in class and to me personally, you've taught about how you told me how you in the class how you've been gaining the ability to think more clearly in life as life occurs. Mm-hmm. That's gaining mastery of your thoughts. You don't have complete mastery of your thoughts, but that's part of the process, isn't it?
Right.
Does that describe it?
I understand it.
And for most of us,
your
that
thoughts is just thoughts. I always hear you say that.
Yes.
Your thoughts are just seeing them that way.
I can see that I was getting mastery over my thoughts, but yeah, I can put that phrase to it now. Yeah.
Yeah, and that again, that's the essence of mindfulness. We gain mastery of our thoughts. We think what we want to think when we want to think it. Another way of saying that is, in the moment, our minds aren't reacting because we're not taking anything personal. And our thoughts are reflective of what's appropriate in the moment. And again, that leads to that what I say often, we're at peace with less than peaceful mind states. It might mean that we recognize, a good example of towards the end of the, one day the Buddha got word that his dad was dying. And the Buddha didn't say, well, my mind is peaceful, I'm a calm, this doesn't affect me. That would be foolish. That would be self-referential, wouldn't it be? That would be ego-driven. It would be using the Dhamma to escape from life. What the Buddha did was completely appropriate. He got up off his cushion and walked 140 miles to be with his dad, so by the way, he could give him one last Dhamma teaching before he died, and he did. And his dad died peacefully, and the Buddha died. The Buddha maintained a calm and peaceful mind. He thought what was entirely appropriate in the moment. That's mindfulness. That's refined mindfulness. We don't lose the ability to think. Most people misinterpret the implications of the Dhamma is that we become either automatons or we lose the ability to interact with life completely, and it's just the opposite. We gain the profound ability to think what we want to think, when we want to think it, when it's appropriate. And it's framed by the Eightfold Path. It's framed by the reality of how life really is. It's framed by understanding the three marks of existence.
So the way I'm seeing what you're saying about the Buddha then getting up off the cushion and going is that he did not then sit there going, well, maybe I should stay here because the Sangha needs me and I should be staying here, or how will it look to this one, or how will this action, you know. So I guess that's what he didn't do, and that's what we do.
Yep.
Yeah,
because we're taking it personal.
What do I do?
It was simply an appropriate reaction hearing your dad's going to die. Yeah, and for him it wasn't a simple matter of getting his car and driving to the next town or getting on a plane.
Right.
A 140-mile walk in northern India 2,600 years ago was an arduous task. But yet he did it. And he did it from... The reason why I tell that story is just that reason. We don't become automatons. We don't lose the ability to think critically when we let go of self-referential views. We gain the ability to think masterfully because it's not clouded by wrong views, the thoughts and our resulting actions and decisions. And think back again about what drew you to spiritual practice in a general way. And by the way, I don't really think this is spiritual practice. It was really something like that, wasn't it? It was something with your thinking that you realized needed some type of... it might not have been that clear in your own thinking, but ultimately it was that. And ultimately the Buddha realized that, and he taught a way of going from wrong views, wrong thoughts, to right views, or master of our thoughts. This is a person with mastery of thought sequences. I love this line, I've said it a few times today. This person thinks what they want to think whenever they want and does not think what is unskillful. Imagine having a mind like that. We don't have to imagine it. We can actually experience it. And we do experience it, even if it's just briefly, in meditation. That brief moment of spaciousness between being caught up in thoughts and being mindful of our breath is a visceral example of that, of having mastery of your thoughts. And in the next moment, we might find that we're caught back in our thoughts again. But we've been given this great tool called Shamatha Vipassana meditation. And we can come back to the moment. We can come back to our breath and gain a little bit more mastery of our thoughts that way. And off our cushions, we've been given an eightfold path. Again, the Buddha realized it wasn't just meditation. He realized that we spend most of our time off our cushions, don't we? Just like he did in the original Sangha did. They didn't spend all their days in meditation, by the way. That's something else that has developed. They meditated for specific periods during the day, and then they spent the rest of their time engaged as best they could within the framework of the Eightfold Path, developing that refined mindfulness that can now be taken off our cushion and applied experientially in human life as life occurs. Human beings do not live their life only in meditation, do they? The Buddha didn't. The original Sangha didn't. Again, I'm making a kind of a backhanded comment on forced, long, like 7 and 10 day meditation retreat, so-called, in silence. That the reason why I don't lead retreats like that is that's completely unrealistic, and it often just reinforces wrong views because there's no framework to change that. The Buddha didn't do that. The Buddha, the original Sangha, didn't spend their time in silence once they walked into Anathapindika's monastery. They listened to the Buddha usually once or twice a day. They interacted with each other. They interacted with the townsfolk when they went and got their one bowl of food for the day. Many of them went out and taught during those alms rounds, and sometimes specifically in other situations. The point is that they lived within the framework of the Eightfold Path, within the walls of the monastery or wherever they were on retreat. That was the point. In the Vinaya, which is the first book of the Pali Canon, which is mostly rules for living within a sangha. One of the first rules is when you're gathered together as a sangha, you speak and act only in accordance with the Eightfold Path, which would make sense, wouldn't it? Because then we're all reinforcing each other and developing the Dhamma. One of the reasons why this sangha has developed the way it has is because the one rule that I kind of insisted on from the beginning, this is going back now, I think, I can't remember. I should remember how long I've been teaching here, but 6 or 8 years maybe, was just that, that when we're here in this room, that we talk and focus only on what can be found in the Sutta Pitakas. And in the beginning, there was often a lot of resistance, and many times people would say, why don't we do this? Why don't we listen to a Tara Brach tape? Why don't we listen to Pema Chodron? Why don't we smudge the place? Why don't we do this exercise? Why don't we do that exercise? And all those things are fine, but they're not part of what the Buddha taught. And they have no place in this Sangha. Because when we're gathered as a Sangha, we teach and practice and discuss within ourselves only what the Buddha taught. And that has made all the difference, hasn't it? You hear me say often, this, and I realize that you don't all have the perspective that I have, but some of you are gaining it. You know, I've been around a lot of different traditions and different sanghas and different centers. This is rather unique to have this well-focused sangha. I don't think it's the only one in the whole world, but I've yet to come across one that is this well-focused on only what the Buddha taught. And it's remarkable, the development. This really comes out during retreats. But even during our classes here, how well we've all developed the Buddha's Dhamma. And it's because we don't have the distraction of other things that we think are Dhamma practice. Excuse me for getting off track just a little bit. And I want to conclude this sutta properly, so I'm going to go back a little bit. This is a person with mastery of thought sequences. This person thinks what they want whenever they want and does not think what is unskillful, such as some of those things that I just alluded to and other things. This practitioner has severed craving and has brought an end to suffering and stress. They think whatever they want and do not think what is unskillful. This practitioner has severed craving and has brought an end to suffering and stress. The Buddha's teaching, the culmination of Dhamma practice. We think whatever we want to think, whenever we want to think it, when it's appropriate. Thank you. What a great sutta. There's, again, like a lot of the suttas, there's a lot packed in there, but I think it gets to the point, too. We can see the conclusion of it, as this is the reason why we're engaged in Dhamma practice, to regain control of our minds, or maybe gain control of our mind, and to think what we want to think when we want to think it. Are there any questions related specifically to this sutta, and then we'll go around the room? And for those online, there is I think you have a chat box. If you want to ask a question, make a comment, or just say hello, that'd be great. We'll start with Jen. Jen, good morning.
Hi,
good to
morning.
See you.
Good to see you. I made a joke about thoughts and how many of them there are in my mind is, from one perspective, it's really impressive. from other perspectives, it's totally overwhelming, and from other perspectives, it's just what's happening.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something that I've really struggled with in life, and just been like completely. Not able to function because of all the thoughts in my head.
Yeah.
And this practice has just been the only thing that has been able to show me which thoughts are valuable and which ones I can let go of. And it's something I'm really appreciative of. And it's not just one single thing that I can say that has taught me. You know, there's so many different things that happen in a day that create, a pile of thoughts or a bundle of thoughts. And something will occur and a bunch of thoughts will arise. And I have like a tool belt of things that immediately cause most of the thoughts to subside and like just a few to stay present, which allow me to see that those are the thoughts that I can focus on. Those are the what's occurring thoughts, the thoughts that will help me be skillful. And sometimes the things that like dampen the other thoughts, if that makes sense, is, like a sutta that I'll remember, a teaching that I'll remember. Or sometimes it's, wow, I'm really overwhelmed by my thoughts right now, I'm gonna reach out to a Sangha member. Or, it's just so many different things. Or it's just, let me apply the Eightfold Path here, like what am I not doing, just take a breath. Or sometimes it's, go for a walk and just get back into the moment, just all of these these things that I have with me but I have gathered just by doing the practice, that it's awesome.
Isn't it?
Then that just kind of hit me when I was like making the joke, and then like listening more to this teaching. It really is about. It really does kind of pull together all the different ways that you can, all of different things that you learn that help you kind of weed through the compost heap of thoughts that are, or the thicket of views that, you know, you deal with all the time. Those always that come up, and they just, the ones that are important seem to. If that's my experience with it. So.
What a great description of thinking what you want to think when you want to think it.
Yeah.
Being able to filter out, recognizing that all this is junk,
mm-hmm.
this is what's important.
Mm-hmm.
That's the essence of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Good morning, Lorna. Good to see you.
I came on Tuesday, and you gave a very good talk on Tuesday, which I was able to... follow through into the following day on Wednesday, which was recognizing your thoughts and recognizing the thoughts, that how you associate yourself with your thoughts. And I described it as a string of thought. I have a string of thoughts, my regular thoughts that this is me, because this is what I think, right? Which is exactly what John was saying. And then so I thought this cemented in my mind on Wednesday. So I thought, sometimes to understand something, you look at the other way. And I thought, well, just think of something that I have nothing to do with, that I can just think about, where I have no history about it or anything else. So what came to mind was marine life at 1 mile down, you know. I mean, I've never lived by the coast, and I'm not a marine person or out to sea or anything. So I thought, well, and I can just think about that, and I'm not attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at the other side made me see my thoughts, you know. And so I wanted then to get back to my thoughts, to reestablish myself. And I kind of like did this on Wednesday in my mind. And I was very mindful, and as I say, this sutta that he gave on Tuesday sort of just penetrated a little bit more. And so anyway, on Wednesday and Thursday, I was conscious of when I got onto a thought that I was associating myself with, this is what I think. And I wrote my thoughts, and as the Buddha said, describes. And I'm going to say something negative about the practice now, so I apologize for that. But if I found that when you really are concentrating on doing that, and you disassociate yourself with the thoughts that you associate yourself with, if that makes sense, as I say, is it going to be negative? Life is very boring.
Yeah.
And I found that I wasn't in a quiet, peaceful mind. I was in a quiet, bored state with life.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this is weird. So that's what I have to say, really. Because you think that if you get rid of your own personal thoughts, you go into this still, quiet, you know, peaceful place. And I didn't. I just sort of got bored. It was boring.
Thank you for saying all that. So you do understand mastery of thoughts. That's what you're describing.
Okay.
That the sutta from Tuesday, just for everybody's reference, was the Nagara Sutta. There's four or five. And last... That talk is on the website too, from Tuesday. That's where the Buddha describes his awakening. And I know that there's times when you had a calm mind that was just calm, and it wasn't calm and bored.
Yeah.
But there's times boredom. I think about this. Boredom is a need in this moment, even though it's not a present moment thought. It's an objectified thought. Is a need for that mind to be right now. I need some distraction. That's why it feels bored.
Mm-hmm.
I want something else to be going on. That's a self-referential view, isn't it? It's objecting to what's occurring right now, which is nothing. It's not enough. There needs to be something feeding me right now, rather than just a calm and peaceful mind. And it, and you can take that, and this is no, this isn't, doesn't mean that you are foolish, but look at the foolishness of it. If I'm bored in this moment, it's because I don't think something's going to happen. All I have to do is take another breath and something's going to happen, isn't it? Whether it's a new thought or a new experience, life continues. But I don't need to be constantly stimulated by what's occurring, because I'm not taking anything personal. It's a mind that is in the moment rooted in taking things personal that becomes bored. It needs something else. It needs some distraction. And thank you for describing it. And it's not right or wrong. What does the Buddha say to do with it? Abandon that thought. Skillfully develop the refined mindfulness. In that moment, I would say that if you recognize that you're bored and you remember to say, this is not me, this is not mine, that might help. But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes all these little tricks that we try don't help at all. And what do? Continue with Dhamma practice. That's the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, right effort. We simply continue. Why? Because we've taken true refuge, which means we understand that a human being actually did this, and he left his teaching for us that is still here 2,600 years later. And that third refuge, it's so remarkable that we have a well-focused Sangha to truly take refuge. And look at the discussion here today. This from the first two folks. It's all on you, Becky, to keep this going.
Oh, the pressure. I really liked listening to this sutta again, because I would say over the last, really kind of over the summer, even though I've been coming and I've been meditating, I haven't had, I've had a very, non-peaceful, garbage, full of garbage mind. And I haven't been able to really use the practice to figure out I haven't used the practice correctly. I have spent too much time trying to analyze why I feel this way, trying to, just get back to feeling good again, whatever that means. Instead of not just saying, but experiencing, this is not me, this is not mine. And today, listening to your teaching again, I was able to see much more what I've been doing. I was able to see that everything that has caused my mind to be agitated was my fabrications, my unwillingness to say, this is just what's happening. My getting stuck in what I think is being done to me, and what I think is happening now, and what I have to do to get done with this. And, I've made it so much worse, this process, than it needed to be because of that. And today, listening to this sutta again, and listening to how to think what you want to think, when you want to think it, and listening especially to the concept of fabrications and what we do when we fabricate and we take everything personally, has made me just do one of those. I can do it. It does work, but it's really hard, and I just have to keep trying. Yeah. Because when you see it and when you get it, just
that one little time again, and then it goes away again. Mm-hmm. It goes away again. But when you see it that one little time again, it just gives you that encouragement that, you know, you are able to know what it is to be on the right path and to be practicing the Dhamma the way it, you know, the way you've learned to practice it. So thank you very much.
Thank you for what you said.
Yeah, it's one was a good one.
Yeah, it is. And thank you for this sutta is all about an awakened human being encouraging us to keep going.
Right.
He says in here that there's going to be times when it doesn't work this way. Then do it this way. Bring mindfulness back. Bring, as it says in the sutta, bring mindfulness to the fore. I mean, be present with what's occurring. Don't analyze it. Don't try to figure out where this feeling comes from. As he teaches in the Satipatthana Sutta, just recognize feelings arise in the instructions that I give in meditation. Notice the arising and passing away of feelings and thoughts. That's all we should be doing with them ever, because they arise and pass away. There's no substance. They're like foam on the ocean. And if we start trying to figure it out, what are we grasping at? Nothing. But because our minds are prone to fabrication, we will fabricate something out of it.
Yeah.
Why? Because I'm thinking about it. I got to make more out of it. I got to make it real for me. It doesn't work. Thank you. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning. I feel like this talk was so perfect for where I am in my life.
Me too.
Not to interrupt you, we said this, I think, Tuesday, too. Almost every talk you can say that to,
yeah,
right?
You're
because
right.
Because it gets to the heart of the matter. I'm sorry for interrupting.
I think it's because when you surround yourself with good people and in good words, that it's going to reflect back,
yeah.
and I was feeling like, you know, wow, I've come a long way with this, because two different things were going on in my life the last couple of weeks, very different, and they both came to a head yesterday, and like I walked away from it thinking I was completely, you know, unemotional, but like one in, and I learned two important lessons. And the one lesson I learned was, sometimes you have to accept things, but sometimes you also have to stand your ground for what is true to your heart. And because the State Bar was really good about letting us do a mindfulness presentation for lawyers, they even gave us 2.5 hours. And then I pitched it to the County Bar, and they were for it. And then I get a call, can you cut it to an hour? And I was like, well, yeah, I could do this, this, and this, and I think I can make that work. And then I get this email with 10 pages of ethics, rules, and codes they want me to talk about and incorporate it. And I'm thinking this through in my head, and I'm thinking, well, it is good to spread mindfulness. Maybe I should try to make this work somehow. Maybe I can cut some of it out. And then I went to yoga on Thursday, and the person who leads a very nice yoga class said it, you know, was talking about being true to your heart and standing up for what you really think is right. And I just called her and I said, I can't do this, you know, because you're asking me to do something that not only do I think I'm going to lose the lawyers once I start preaching laws and rules, but you're taking it in the opposite direction from where I want to be. And it felt so liberating to hang up the telephone and say, I don't care if they ask me to do this, you know, I feel good that I just stuck my ground.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, like, I had my biggest case, which is 4.5 years old now and had 9 extensions for discovery. The other attorney wanted everything under the sun after we had already had a trial for Tuesday. And that just shouldn't have happened that way. And we made motions and we argued. And as soon as I got in the judge's chambers, he just let me know, I'm going to give him everything he wants. I said, but this case will go on another year. And that was just his mindset. And I just didn't feel, I just said, you know what? The world isn't here to serve me.
Yeah.
That, and it was so true to this thing. And I was thinking, you know, the judge doesn't, not like, it's not that the judge doesn't like me, the adversary's doing his job. This is just the way it is, you know, accept it.
Yeah, dukkha occurs.
Yeah, stuff happens.
Yeah.
And it felt good to just think I was, because before that would have freaked me out. My mind would have been racing. I would have been angry, and I was just completely unemotional about it, because I thought that's just, and it felt good to know that I didn't feel bad.
But also that you,
Please, Becky.
You were able to react differently in both of those, or respond differently in both of those situations.
And appropriately.
In one, you accepted it. This is just the way it is. And the other one, you were, because of your mindfulness, you realized I can't do it this way, you know, and to know how to react in both of those situations, or how to respond in both those situations, it's really cool, you know.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
You
thank
really,
you.
And they both worked out.
Yeah, I think it's like accept what you can't control,
mm-hmm.
and control what you don't want to accept.
Right.
Yeah.
Or what,
well,
you see that you don't have to accept.
You don't have
right,
to accept.
Yeah. You don't
and
have
the,
to accept. I mean, yeah.
The interesting thing about that, how the county came back to you, is lawyers that are resting in refined mindfulness don't need to worry about all this ethics stuff. They'll just naturally be ethical. You know, it's an outpouring of mindful behavior.
You know, and I got that the person didn't understand it at all, because the response was, I know you want to do all this touchy-feely stuff,
yeah.
but lawyers need to learn things.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking in my head, wait a second, the greatest thing you can learn is to calm down.
Yeah.
And
you're right, they don't understand it. maybe they will, and you'll be able to do it. But
the State Bar did.
Yeah.
I mean, there are openings, but, you know, just sometimes.
That's just remarkable, Anthony, you know, the transformation. I remember the first phone call we had when you gave me a call, and what you've learned about, and not just learned, what you've actually integrated about the Buddha's teachings is really remarkable. And then to see you bringing it into the lawyer profession, which is by necessity adversarial, it has to be adversarial or it doesn't work, but you can be mindful in that adversarial situation. It's just remarkable.
You should be.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you're my lawyer, I want you to work for me. I mean, that's the whole point of that system, you know, if you're in it. So thank you, Anthony.
Thank you. Thank
good morning, Poppy. Good to see you. How's your practice going?
Slow.
better now, I hope, now that you're here.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I got so much out of the sutra today,
yeah.
but a couple things just kind of hit me. I think for me, the first thing is unskilled thoughts, just how they can give us such a different, from person to person, such a different experience of life. While we're here on Earth, right?
Yeah.
Just, it can vary so greatly from person to person,
yeah.
you know. They can, those unskilled thoughts have such an impact on what we're experiencing.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And then the second thing that kind of hit me, and I read it somewhere, just, and it applies, you know, to this teaching, is just letting go, letting creation just be, right? Not trying to control others, push others to do what you want. Just, there's like a beauty in just letting creation be, letting people be, just almost be like being an observer, just letting things happen, letting creation just unfold.
That's great insight, Poppy. That you're, you know, it's getting to the heart of the matter. And John Lennon was right. Let it be. Eva, good to see you this morning.
John, it's great to be here. It's great to be here with everyone. The only thing I have to say is that I enjoy being in the energy and in the atmosphere and the wisdom that happens when we come here and are together. Thank you, John.
Thank you for being a part of it. You're a big part of the energy here. So I'm glad you're here. Matt, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you. I don't think I'll be any different to say that this didn't have an impact on myself as well. I feel like I'm in a similar mode. I have the same issue where my mind, like she said, she'd like her mind's boring. It was boring. Just in some cases, I'd love to have that because my mind, it feels like it's just constantly going.
Yeah.
When I go to sleep, it's going. I get up, it's going, and it's all, a lot of it's just useless thoughts in a sense that they're just thoughts. They're not what's gonna important to me in the daily life. Some of it is, some of it isn't. Some of it's just thinking about things that I have no control over, or things that maybe I want to have control over, but. And that's why I'm here, because I want to learn how to control my mind, to focus on what's really important, and to get those unskillful thoughts, to tame them, to realize how to live in the now, and not live in the past, not live in the future, but to be here today, and to have that mind that I'm taking in. I mean, it's interesting. Where I work, there's a park that I walk at lunchtime. I started to, instead of sitting at my desk and eating at lunchtime, I eat while I'm working real quick, and then I go out and I walk. And it's basically it's a hiking trail. And then there's some days when I walk, and the whole time I'm thinking about work, or I'm thinking about this or that. But then there's some days where I'm in the woods, and all of a sudden there's a calmness that comes over, and the sky's a different color. I'll notice a bird that's feels like half a mile away. I'll see it where normally I'd walk past it and not notice it, and I'll hear things, and it's just such a wonderful place to be at. And but as fast as it comes, it goes, and it's trying to figure out how I can harness that to go through life like that, where I'm seeing colors a different way, or seeing the world a different way, and just enjoying the day for what it is, and not what I want it to be, or what others want it to be, or it's an amazing thing. And this really brought me back to really the heart of that. What that is, and it's that how you see life, and how your mind sees life, and how to separate those things to go back to those, that day in the woods when I saw the world differently and saw nature differently.
Yeah. Wow, thank you so much for that description. You're describing the essence of being mindful with life as life occurs. a bird a half mile away becomes meaningful. Not for any other reason except it's there in your life. That's the secret to happiness, isn't it? And that the mind that you described as you started talking is what so many people talk about, why they come here. That's what I was saying. There's a reason why we come to this. And usually it's because we're disappointed in something, and usually it's the way we're thinking. The common term for that is monkey mind. We can't come to grips with, it just never stops, it never stops. But it does. That's simply a compulsion rooted in wrong view of an insatiable self-referential ego self always grasping at the next thought. And so it fills its own head up with thoughts, because that's what it's enamored with, like Jen was describing. The Buddha recognized that 2,600 years ago. And he gave us a simple and direct practice. It's not easy at times, but it is simple and gets right to the heart of the matter. So thank you. What a remarkable discussion again this morning.
I find nature very grounding too sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. It really facilitates being in the present moment. Just
a lot of times if I'm meditating, I'll open the window up and just hear, what are those insects called that make that humming sound?
Cicadas.
No, there's another one out. I know the one you're talking about.
They keep going.
It's
like
it's so like I can really get into my meditation by listening to it.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the Zen school uses nature. Because of that, and of course, they cut out a lot of what the Buddha teaches, but it's reflected in Japanese and Chinese and Korean Zen. They really use nature in that way, in a very beautiful way. Again, they cut out a lot of what the Buddha taught about. Please.
Well,
getting talking about these strings of thoughts that we associate ourselves with, it's almost like it's, this is again not maybe a correct way to say it, but it's almost like a relaxation to go to get out of mindfulness and into your string of thought. It, you kind of, I've noticed that I kind of do it you know, to get into your own story in your own mind is, in a way, it kind of relaxes yourself.
It feels like that.
That's not what you've...
It feels like that because it's familiar, and it is a distraction. You know, that's why we, you know, that's why we engage in things like that. But it is just the string of thoughts is saying another way of saying conditioned thoughts.
Yeah.
And so, because it's familiar, it does feel. You could apply the word relaxing. But it is just another distraction, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it leads to disappointment. And that's a good point. Just because something feels good doesn't mean that it's Dharma practice or it's even helpful. You know, to me, there was a long period in my life where a bottle of vodka every day felt good.
Mm-hmm.
You
know?
And it was the only thing I could, at that point, it was the only thing I could do, thinking that I was relaxing when, in fact, I wasn't.
You know,
getting passed out on the floor looks like you're relaxed. It's not. And I'm using an extreme example for anything that we might use. Some people use food. You know, some people use sex, some people use golf, some people use work, some people use TV, reading, et cetera, et cetera. It does feel good. There's a reason why some of the most recent billionaires became rich because they figured out a way to really distract us.
Yeah.
It keeps us going, doesn't it? But just because I think it, just because it feels good, recognize the impermanence of it. Recognize this is not me, this is not mine. And you know, the Buddha would use the words, and maybe I should too, the wise know the danger and even the slightest
discretion.
Mm-hmm. So just because the quart of vodka feels good,
I
buried a lot of my friends that didn't get the ability to recognize how destructive that can be. But again, that's just an extreme example of other things that we use that make us feel good that are simply just a distraction from our own life. And why would we want to? I mean, I remember when I finally sobered, I was 26 years old. And after you sober up, if you're in that community, you're asked to go up and tell your story. And the first time I did, I didn't know, I was shivering and shaking. Oh, the worst thing I ever did was talk in front of people. Look at me now. And I think I only spoke for about 5 minutes. You're given a half hour. But these words came out of my mouth, and I was shocked. I said, I finally become peaceful in a less than peaceful world. I don't even know where they came from. And I mean, and that stopped me even in my talk. And I didn't understand what I was saying until much later. But I gave up the one thing that was taking me, I thought it was bringing, the only thing that could bring me peace, was actually creating constant conflict in my mind. You think about an addict's mind, no matter how much you got, you want more. And I remember, you know, getting towards the end of the bottle, I want more. But we do that with everything, don't we? You know, I eat chocolate cake, one piece isn't enough. An engaging conversation, we want more, you know. Great this, great that, want more. Instead of being satisfied with what's occurring, with noticing a bird that we didn't notice before. Because that's real. And that's something we don't have to do anything for except be present. We don't have to fabricate anything. Thank you for bringing that up. A few things I wanted to bring up. We've been collecting money for Rare Art and Learning Cooperative to buy a sign. Today's the last day that we're going to collect, and we're going to make a presentation Tuesday to Mary Beth, and she'll be here. So if you can join us for that little bit of celebration right at the beginning of class on Tuesday. And they'll be able to put a nice sign out in front of it. It really is a great school what they're doing there. So your support is greatly appreciated. Our retreat is less than a month. Begins September 20th, ends on the 23rd. It's a great way to integrate the Dhamma for those that can attend.
The 20th? I keep hoping Thursday of 20th?
20th, yeah, Thursday's
okay.
The 20th. But if you wanted to go, you know,
the
you could
Tuesday,
come on.
The 18th, you are doing class.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and it'll be the Wednesday talk, but no Thursday or Saturday class.
Okay.
But again, as long as there's no technical glitches, there'll be video, there'll be streamed live, those classes there, but there's no substitute for what you gain out of a retreat. And it looked like this stream looks like it's still recording audio, so I think they fixed the glitch. One of our online Sangha members, Sarah from up in Maine, she has a beautiful voice and a beautiful guitar presence, and she put my Metta Intentional Meditation to song, and so I thought that we'd close tonight's class with that. And it's on the website too, on the, yeah, on the guided meditation page. So let me just find it. And hope that it really, she's really beautiful, and you'll hear it. So again, let me make sure it works. Make sure I have it. Yeah, here it is. So find your relaxed meditation posture, and again, gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth, and just take a moment to become mindful of your in breath and your out breath. And this is Metta Intentional Meditation, played by Sarah. I gotta wait for it to load. There it is.
May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, very nice. Thank you, Sarah.
That's on the website?
Yeah, it's on the guided meditation page.
Did you download it?
I think so. If not, let me know and I'll get you the link. Then you can download it that way. But I think you can. Yeah, what a wonderful class.
Great
Sangha.
Great
Sangha. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.